This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
What's up, peeps? Welcome back to Rebound and Safety. This week, we are kicking off our next mini-series. Let's jump into the intro. I'll tell you more about it, and we'll tell you the structure of a mini-series now that it's a little bit different in how we structure all our content at Rebound and Safety. Let's jump into the intro.
The problem in safety isn't deviation, it's complexity.
Health and safety has gone mad.
Health and safety is trying to unpick having gone mad in the past.
There's no one solution and one problem. The problem is that we are looking for one solution.
Does the structure of the team allow them to flourish?
Feel safe enough to be uncomfortable.
The environment defines our behaviors.
People aren't the problem, they're the solution.
Rebranding Safety, crushing the stereotype. Brought to you by Risk Fluent.
What's up, peeps? Welcome back to Rebranding Safety. Rebranding Safety is the YouTube channel and podcast doing exactly what it says on the tin. We change the perception of health and safety, and we do that right here. So hit that subscribe button and the bell and all those things that do the magical algorithm thingy-majiggies. I bet that you guys can probably quote that line as well. I feel like one day I'm going to go to the expo and people are just going to walk past me and say that. Like, what's up, James? Peter McKinnon wannabe. Yeah. Peter McKinnon of safety. I'll take that. Anyway, get back into it, James. Focus. We are starting a mini-series, but a quick word from our sponsors and I'll tell you some more about it. So those of you that work in a small, medium-sized enterprise, those kind of businesses that are just absolutely ramo all the time, and safety is maybe something that just falls by the wayside. It's conscious and you do it, but you know, maybe you just need to do a little bit better and you want some extra support. Paradigm Human Performance have the option for you, the solution for you. It's a HSE subscription service. Paradigm Human Performance is all about educating people. They're all about getting worker safety as a DNA of your company. They're all about teaching you to understand the subject matter expertise and exploit the subject matter expertise of the worker. Their HSE subscription service is designed to make you compliant, but it's also got that kind of HOP specialism woven into it. So this isn't a kind of system that you're going to implement and then have to work on in a few years, you know, even though you do need to continually kind of keep it up to date, you know, obviously. But this isn't a system that in 10 years' time, 5 years' time, 2 years' time, you're going to go, oh my God, I need to declutter. This has got HOP woven throughout it. So if this sounds like the option for you, then there's email address, phone number and website in the description below. But if you're not quite sure yet and you're thinking, who the hell is Paradigm Human Performance, then go to the website and check out the Learning Organization webinar. Every Thursday at 2 o'clock, Paradigm Human Performance host a webinar giving away unbelievable amount of education, unbelievable amount of content, and the people, the conversations, the audience, the chat box, it's all phenomenal. So if you're not quite sure, you want to find out who Paradigm are they really what they say they are? Are they really what James says they are? Go check out that webinar because you'll learn pretty quick. The caliber of knowledge in that webinar is top notch. It really is. It's free of charge. And not only do you get that webinar, then the next one, you also, once you log in, you get all the backlog. And there is so much. So go check that out. Paradigm Human Performance team are there pretty much every week. Nearly all of them are there. You can just get to feel for them. You can hear them. You can see them. You can understand their expertise as well and their style and their personality. So you cannot just dive in blind. You get to know these people before you sign up. So go check Paradigm Human Performance out. Email address, phone number and website in the description below. And just a quick comment from Project Miletium, which is my company co-founded with Colin Nottage. We're the only mastermind community for anyone that manages safety, health, risk, focused on developing you, challenging you, solving your problems, and pushing you to be better, ultimately making a better profession one person at a time. We run weekly community calls where we all help each other solve each other's problems. We talk about our wins as well, which is something that we lack so much in safety. Talking about what went well, understanding the presence of positives within our profession. We also run a philosophy call, which is the only safety philosophy call regularly, conversation, whatever you want to call it, being had in the safety profession. There's nothing like that anywhere else. We also run a book club where we read books, obviously, and then we come and learn about what other people learn from the book, which is kind of like reading a book and learning from it on steroids. And then we run a quarterly wagon wheel, which is a mastermind event 3.5 hours on a Saturday morning. You're like, what? I'm not doing 3.5 hours on a Saturday morning. It's worth it. You get a keynote speaker, but then not only do you have that keynote speaker, you get to go in a workshop with that keynote speaker and get a real up close personal conversation with them about how you're going to use the information that they've just told you. So if this sounds like it's right for you, we are a growing community. It's growing fast. We've only been going 4 months. Go to www.projectmiletium.com. The website's in the description below. But if you're still not sure and you want to try it free of charge, that's fine. Give me a call, DM me, email me, or Colin Nottage. Either of us will get you in the community and in one of our weekly calls. Free of charge, you can try it out and then see how you go. And if you're still not sure, then just go find some of our members. I'm always sharing stuff. And just connect with some of our members and ask them, what do you think? And trust me, the response you'll get will make you want to join. Okay, let's jump into this kind of year's mini-series. I don't know. We're going to do another mini-series maybe this year. Actually, no, we're not. We're not this year. This mini-series runs all the way up to next year. What? Yes. But we're doing it a little bit differently than what we did the last mini-series of Safety 1 and Safety 2. We're only going to do the mini-series episodes on the first Monday of the month going forward. The reason for that is because, well, we wanted to give you a bit of diversity of our content as well. We didn't want to just be talking about this all the time. And, you know, Safety 1, Safety 2 mini-series, it was every week and it was a long slog. And I think that maybe some of us were a bit like, oh, I could do with some normal content. So there will be a mini-series episode out on the first Monday, then they'll be on the following Wednesday-ish. There'll be a reflection episode from me, but then the following Monday we'll be back into kind of normal random content. So what is this mini-series about? Well, I was actually a bit nervous about this mini-series because this mini-series is all about diversity. And diversity is a really sensitive space and one that is a bit of a minefield when you're having open and honest conversations around how to speak and what words to use and what's right and what's wrong. And some people open up in this mini series and tell us some really personal stories for them. Excuse my phone. And I was really nervous about saying something and that being interpreted the wrong way because, well, I have a unique way of talking really. And sometimes I can do that and not realize that tone is very important. So I just wanted to kind of use this opportunity to say a little kind of caveat, a little bit of a disclosure that this mini-series is coming from the right place. I think in a safety profession, our lack of diversity is causing our problems. I think our lack of diversity is meaning that is resulting in a lack of innovation, a lack of development, a lack of new ideas. So I'm doing this to kind of expose stories, to show the benefits of different diversities from gender, from ethnicity, from sexual preference as well. And the aim is to try and show the potential and expose the stories and the challenges that these people have gone through and what makes them so resilient and what makes them so beneficial to your company. So please keep that in mind as we're going through these conversations because it is a very difficult conversation to have. And I'll say something like this at the beginning of every episode because I don't want someone to misinterpret anything that either me or my guests have said. Just please understand that both me and all of our guests are coming from a position where we want to make the safety profession better and more diverse and more inclusive. Thanks for just bearing with me on that. I appreciate your time. Okay, so who are we talking to today? Well, we're kicking off this episode with someone who is getting increasingly popular and is such an amazing lady. And she's experienced some challenges through her career. And she tells us very honestly about these challenges and we talk really openly with each other. And it's a great episode to kick off this mini-series. Today's guest is Jessie Gomez. So please enjoy, get in deep, listen to Jessie's story, and then we'll continue and kick off this mini-series of diversity within the safety profession. Let's go. Right, Jessie, welcome to Rebranding Safety.
Thank you for inviting me.
That's all right. Thank you very much for coming on. We've been chatting for a hell of a long time trying to get this going. So it's actually really nice to press the record button and have a good chat with you.
Thank you for inviting. I'm really excited about our chat.
They all say that. I wonder whether that's just what people say in general. I'm really excited about this, but actually just something I don't want to get out of the way. Why don't you give us a very brief introduction? We're gonna talk quite heavily about you anyway and your journey, but why don't you kind of just give us a brief introduction to yourself, and then we'll probably dive in deep to that introduction.
Yeah, so I will say in a nutshell that I've been known for working within the construction industry and principally for my ambassador role within IOSH. So I arrived in UK about 10 years ago looking for my first opportunity in UK, looking to improve my language skills, learn about a new culture, a new way of working, and also gain an experience in health and safety in a foreign country, because I was born in France an extended of time ago, and I was looking to gain global and international experience. And for me, the closer to France was to come in UK to be able to perform. And since then, I never left. So I started to work within the construction industry as a construction design manager and health and safety advisor, working from a wide range of industry, from retail to healthcare, to banking, property development lately. So I've really touched down a variety of clients in a consultancy world in health and safety. So this is what I can pretty say about my background. And obviously, I also mentioned about my ambassadorial work and advocacy work to change and shape the future of the health and safety profession, but also the construction industry landscape. So I'm a council member of IOSH. I've been elected by the membership. And I'm using my voice as much as I can to reflect the view of the membership into IOSH as a global health and safety organization globally. So it's what I do at the moment, yeah.
And we're going to talk quite a lot around kind of like a diversity point of view and trying to promote that and understand it a little bit better. And I think understanding it, like, and it's, that sounds a bit kind of maybe naive in a way, but like, I do think it's important for us to kind of maybe separate ourselves from what we see in the media and social media when we talk about diversity, but to actually understand the people in this, because in the end of the day, you know, when we talk about diversity, we're talking about people. So I think it'd be really interesting to just kind of understand you a little bit more. And then, you know, as a kind of safety professional, as a woman and so on and so forth. But what was that like coming from, you know, France over to the UK, that transition? Were you English speaking when you came over, or how was that shift? Because I mean, for me, I've lived a very sheltered life, you know, born and raised in Northamptonshire in England, and I, not other than going on a holiday, have not really left Northamptonshire, didn't go to uni or anything like that. So for me, you know, that just seems like a challenge that I couldn't even imagine, going to a different country with a different language, trying to start a career and so on and so forth, find somewhere to live and all of those stuff, to, you know, just learning the culture and stuff like that. Even though it's still within, you know, the European Union, so to speak, that still must have been a massive shift.
It was actually, because coming from France, you will think that they a global interest and everybody knows about being able to express themselves and understand the English language, but the reality is not that shiny, because when I was in France, despite having studied English, when you don't practice it every day and you don't have this living experience, it's not the same. So the milestone and the leading event for me to come in UK, it's when I always been a practical person. I did my study in sandwich course, which is mean I was studying, but also I was working, and really practical experience. So I finished my bachelor degree, which was in risk management in biological industry. And at that time I was working for a manufacturer. They manufacture jam for the cake industry, ice cream industry. I finished my internship there and I got the opportunity to have this global role within the organization, something incredible. And I applied for it and it was like a global interest role. And it was about a sustainable development and being the sustainable director in France and being able to interact with your other counterparts, colleagues all across the world. So I went for the interview, could come across really well speaking in French and describing what I did for the company during my year internship and the various impacts that I had. But unfortunately, when we had to switch and have to speak in English, I had a complete blank. I wasn't comfortable. I couldn't have the words and I couldn't express myself. So as a result of that, I just didn't get the job. And I promised to myself that I will never miss the job opportunity because I just don't speak English. And for me, this is what when I decided that I'm gonna go abroad. And UK was like the easiest way because 2 hours and 20 minutes from Paris, it was really the great alternative for me to come in London and to learn English from this living experience point of view. So, of course, it was a lot of challenges. The only things I could do when I first arrived was smiling at people because you... people said something to you and it just don't go through your ear. This is simple as that. The communication channel wasn't existing. There were no communication from my hands. The only things I could respond is like with a smile. And the smile was like, I'm sorry, but I just don't understand what you're saying. So it took me a year. And within that year, I find a job, and this is because I've been given the opportunity. Someone sees the potential in me and gives me the opportunity to start working as a CDM, despite not having a really heavy background in CDM, because in France, we have the equivalent of the UK CDM, which is coming from the European regulation, but it wasn't exactly a copy and paste and not exactly the same. And you have a lot of like cultural changes about around the legislation background. So I really had to have this notion of understanding what is the context behind CDM in UK, in the UK. So I literally learned English and learned CDM on a job. So it was just like one of the most challenging year of all my life because I had to sit down and in front of men because this is the reality. I remember one of my first meeting and it was a design meeting on site, a lot of noise. I was like quiet, really, really shy. And I had to speak as a CDM advisor. You will expect to be really expressive, to be really confident, and I wasn't. This is the truth. I wasn't coming across as I come across today. I was really diminishing myself. I was really quiet because, and I was speaking really fast. I was speaking English really fast because I was trying to end the sufferance of like having to talk. And I remember this architect saying to me, "Can you please speak up?" And I was like, "Oh my God!" I was like, I had like sweat, and it was really, really hard. And you know, when you become uncomfortable, it's when the growth happens. And I mean, I didn't have another choice. I was there. I had the job, and I had to grow really quickly. So I had to exponentially increase my knowledge of CDM, increase my confidence, increase my communication skills, increase the way I express myself, the way I understand, the way I listen to the client and the feedback. So it's been like the most like the learning experience so I will never forget because it was really painful. And also you look different as well, you know. CDM advisor, we came from the planning supervision era and 1994, then 2007 came the second revamp of CDM, and you there, you know. And you're the one who has to be, oh, we're not doing what the planning supervisor used to do. I'm now a CDM advisor. And this is the way I do things. And sometimes you have to interpret the code of practice because it gives like a lot of freedom. So I had to try to understand how I'm going to translate this approved code of practice into my project, because at the end of the day it's nearly like a personal style to deliver the legislation for you follow the legislation, but you also have to find a way to work through with your emotion and your emotional intelligence principally. Mm-hmm. How do you understand the client concern in terms of cost, in terms of timing, and how do you communicate with them to try to say that you can't compromise the health and safety on site. And this is what was really challenging the first time I arrived. Yeah.
I can relate that, you know, when you said about that, having that smile and just going, I have no idea what you just said. I can totally relate to that. Being hard of hearing, I have that a lot, that kind of, and you get to that point, don't you, where, and I'm not saying that it's, you know, anywhere near as difficult as not understanding the language, but I can relate a little bit, but you do get to that point where you feel really awkward asking pardon or saying, sorry, can you repeat yourself like more than once or twice? And that takes like quite a lot of kind of cojones, really, like some real resilience in your character to be able to just go, I'm really sorry, but I still don't understand what you're saying, because you're worried about offending them as well. Like, and it seems to be, I don't know about you, but from my perception as a kind of I don't know, a disabled person, I suppose. I don't really like to label myself with that, but you know, having a disability, the onus seems to be on the recipient of the communication. Do you know what I mean? Not the communicator. I feel like when you go, sorry, I didn't understand that, they just say the same thing again. Like, and it's like, well, that's not going to work, because obviously I didn't hear you right the first time round. Like, there's no slowing down or explaining it in a different way, or maybe enunciating a little bit. The emphasis is always on the recipient, the communicatee, as opposed to the communicator. I feel like we need to shift that. I don't know. Was that your experience as well?
Yeah, I do agree. The effort had to come a lot from me, and as a non-English speaker, as a person who wants to learn, you always have to be really proactive. This is the thing, and I think that the person that you have in front of you, it's more inactive and more yeah, have less proactivity to try to help you out. So the effort is really coming from you. And sometimes it's like, it's just don't go. It's just don't pass. You're here. And I remember it's like being deaf and the first time you start hearing things and you're like, wow, I can actually understand what the person in front of me is saying. And you take a shift. I take a shift, yeah. But I must say, I've been really lucky because I had a mentor and he was like really good to repeat things, correcting me, because I know that there's a bit of a stigma of like British people thinking like, oh, I'm not gonna correct, it's not polite, they're not gonna be. And I think that if from the beginning I had people who were correcting me, the lot of mistakes I will not be doing now. And I'm still making mistakes in English. My English is not perfect, but it's just enough to get by. So it's fine. Yeah. I can do my job. Mm.
It's interesting that you mentioned like being proactive. Is that, was that a big driver in like, because you've achieved a lot in your career whilst you've been here, you know, your PhD, MBA, you know, published research.
I haven't anything published yet.
Oh, sorry. My apologies.
I hope to publish, and my PhD is ongoing. It's a long process. And I'm really grateful that I have this opportunity to go through the process, and it's a long process. It's tedious, and you need a lot of concentration to have to go through. So I'm still going through it. Yeah, and I hope to come up, you know, the side. Yeah.
And you've got, like, you know, you, like you said earlier, you're the IOSH, you know, council member. You're really active as well on social media and stuff. Was the fact of, like, you're from a different country, you know, a different race, the potential language barrier, was the driver in getting this stuff, that was it, like, I need to have these kind of bits on paper to prove that I am just as good, or was it just the same as everybody else, like, I just want to progress in my career, or maybe a bit of both? Or
I think that I could have been from any ethnicity. This is like me being human and being passionate, having thirst for learning and knowledge, having thirst to change and challenge the construction industry, to always get better and better, to disrupt the status quo and to change the landscape of the profession. So IOSH, the PhD, all of these are just like tools that will allow me to have like a more purpose, career and purpose life. Mm. So I think this is how I'm looking at things. It's like, it's not because I'm from another ethnicity that I'm doing what I do. It's more from a human perspective. It's being who I am. It's giving me the strength to go further. But you're probably right. It's my background. It's the fact of my education, my parents pushing me, saying that I will always have to work harder, which was truth. And it's demonstrated really truth that sometimes you could be facing the same person and your counterpart, and not being paid the same and not being given the same chance. And yes, but I think it's a good mix of both. Yeah.
Because I've the reason I came to that question, I was just thinking about it whilst we were talking, and I listened to quite a lot to, it's a kind of cliche, but I watch a lot of Gary Vaynerchuk, and he's like a very successful, those that don't know, like hugely successful China trader, a businessman, etc. in America, and emigrated at a very young age with his parents from Russia, and he talks about that quite a lot, in that, you know, he says, you know, businesses should be looking to employ more immigrants to their business, because these are resilient people. These are people that will work a damn sight harder, because when they got here, you know, they weren't given that kind of they were given nothing. It was they've made the decision to come over, potentially a language barrier, and have had to work it themselves. So he kind of comes at it from that perspective, that, you know, they're more resilient and they work a lot harder. I'm not saying that you know, a different, you know, like English people don't work hard. That's not the point. And I think people always get to that point of, well, I work hard as well. That's not my point. My point is that I am very aware, extremely aware, that just because of where I was born, I am privileged. Like that I don't think I can change that fact. It doesn't change the fact that I've still worked really bloody hard to get where I am. No one can take that away from me. But I'm very appreciative of the fact that I would not have wanted to do everything I do now in a country where I don't understand the language, the culture, the people, et cetera, et cetera. That's inevitably going to be more challenging, surely.
Yeah, I've been told in my career that I had people who said to me, you're crazy. I would have never went in another country and had to learn a new language and learn a new job. It's hard. I'm not going to say that my journey has been easy, and it's still hard today. And the more I'm going to advance in my advocacy of like having more diverse workforce in construction, more visibility at top and senior management level of people who look different. I think for me, I will be keeping standing, and I know that it makes people feel really uncomfortable, and I want to say that it's not about them. The people have to stop feeling uncomfortable about how the people journey and fight. This is nothing against someone. This is just me trying to have to do my purpose in life. If I want to have a purpose life, and if it's mean having to speak about my own experience, I think people should be respectful, because I respect other people. I respect other experience. I listen. And when I see someone else fight, I just don't take it as an attack for myself. I'm like, okay, how can we synergize and how can I help this marginalized group? It could be any group. It doesn't have to be a group who look like me. And how can we synergize and work all together to try to change? Because today is this group, but tomorrow it could be another group. And I think the fundamental, it's about human rights. It's not about a certain group in this society. It's really, if we really focus in human and kindness, we will not have to have any talk about, this is make me feel uncomfortable because you having this personal fight. I mean, it's not, don't take it personally, I want to say, yeah.
Yeah, there is that kind of, I don't know whether it's English culture or what, but I've had to challenge myself with that sometimes, that when I say, it could be something simple like, oh God, I feel really knackered today. And sometimes it feels like the person you're talking to has to kind of justify that they're also feeling very tired. Like, do you know what I mean? Like that, it's sometimes people are a bit like that. Like, just because I say, you know, just because you say the challenges that you've had coming over from France, being part of like a BAME community, et cetera, like I don't then have to respond and say, well, Jesse, I'm from a working class background and that was just as hard. Like they're both challenges. They're both challenges. They're challenges in their own right. But your challenge doesn't take anything away from mine, and mine doesn't take anything away from yours.
Yeah, I think this is a real issue. It's about, it's about being emotionally clever. It's something that I'm going to be using all the time, listening to other people and be empathetic and just acknowledge. You don't have to be, you can agree to disagree and it's fine, but you can't remove any legitimacy to someone else's fight. This is a thing.
No, exactly. 100%. And I'd like to bring us to one thing, to all this time whilst you've moved to a different country, you're learning a different language, you're starting a new career, you're going through qualifications, you know, that is a huge, any one of those, I think, is a big challenge for any. If I was to look at them, you know, I nearly have a mental breakdown just moving house. and you've kind of done all that, you know, in a kind of short amount of time.
But I had a mental breakdown too. And I think people need to know that we're not, people who do all what I do or different things, we're not superhuman. I'm a human. And at some time you break under the pressure. And I did. Last year, I had my baby girl. And I had my PhD ongoing. I was coming back from maternity leave. I just finished the leadership program within a construction, major construction company. And And when you see the lack of emotional intelligence of certain people in front of you, it's when sometimes you break. And I did. I just had a mental breakdown. And today, I'm not afraid to have to speak about it, because for months I couldn't speak about it, and just thinking about it, I was crying, talking about it. And now I feel like I'm in another stage of like grieving the fact that I was like really down, and now I'm up. And I think life is this, it's like up and down. Mm-hmm. And you need to be really secure, put your seatbelt, and being able to jump on a bump when it's happening, and learn. I think this is the most important thing. It's like, you don't lose, you always learn. And it's something like I do into my PhD too. It's about, what are the lessons? What do we learn? How do we share this lesson? And what I do today, it's just, I'm just sharing the lesson of being a woman in construction, and coming back from maternity leave, and to be honest, the emotional breakdown was a complete reaction to the way and to the reflection that the society and the firm can sometimes reflect it to you, and putting a mirror and said, yeah. So I think it's really crucial. I want to speak about it, because I think, you know, a lot of as women, we just don't speak about it. We have a baby, we just come back to work. No, this is not what's happening. Mm. We have things going through our body. Mm. You full of hormones when you come back, and proper risk assessment should be done. And the way people talk to you, the way your return is dealt with, it's crucial. I think it will avoid a lot of women to go into a postnatal depression, because it has to be a systemic approach within the organization. And the rehabilitation and the return to work from parents from maternity leave need to be really, really well viewed. And you can't just let one standalone manager do whatever he wants when a woman come back. It's like there are a lot of implication in the woman family and life and mental health.
You went to the exact place I was going to try and take us to. So well done. I was going to say, is for all this time, and then you decide to have a baby as well, and I've just had our baby in the house.
Congratulations! Yeah.
Thank you. And I was going to say, that in itself is, and I know everyone says it, and everyone knows the obvious stuff, the sleepless nights and stuff like that, but it's so much more than that. It just seeing the peaks and troughs, like you absolutely nailed it, that my wife has gone through in the short amount of time we've been home. Her and the baby have been home now for just coming up to a month. Baby's about a month old. So, it's not just the sleepless nights. It's all of this other stuff. It's that, what are you trying to think about? It's the money. It's the baby. It's a constant. The constant worrying if you're doing something wrong, right? Is she too hot? Is she too cold? Is she feeling up? Why is she crying? I'm fed up. It's all of this stuff. And that is just constant stress. Like, if we're talking about stress and well-being at work, we always say, a little bit of stress is good, right? But it prolonged stress is never good.
It's a prolonged effect of stress. And you have like a lot of physiological effect, and I had to go through that, and it's just, you can't just keep going with that amount of stress. This is not human. The stress reaction and respond in your body is natural. It will allow you to fight or flight when you are in situation of danger. But you can't keep all these hormones in your body for a prolonged amount of time. And I had to go through that. And it was just, you just lose your mental abilities. You can't think straight. You can't take decision. And you have to take a step back. And you have to check back in. And it's something that I learned, James, during my journey of having to break down and putting the piece of JC again, and like being here and standing in front of you and in front of your audience to speak about it. It's a journey. And I thought I will never see the light. I thought that, oh my God, my career is finished. I don't want to work anymore in the construction industry. They just don't understand women. This is my experience once again, because I know that the people out there will be, no, we treat women really well when they come back. And I think that, yeah, it's good, but this is my experience that I'm sharing today.
I think the key is, the key is there is context, I think. So I will kind of exactly nail what I think you're trying to get at. So I would never, ever say that I have ever treated a woman unfairly, but I would approach a maternity return to work risk assessment in a completely different light now I've seen my wife.
Of course, yeah.
So
of course.
Context, I think, in a lot of places. And I think a lot of men can go through, you know, childbirth with their wife. And it depends how we look at it. You know, I think through all the work I've done in the podcast and safety and trying to learn a bit of psychology and sociology and things like that, I've been really lucky to be in a place where I can look at it a little bit different. And Jesus Christ, I would look at a return to work so differently now. And I think there's more that needs to be done from a policy point of view. Just from that, I think we fail to, I've always said, but I feel like we're a one problem nation and probably a one problem world. So we talk about maternity, for example, we can only talk about that. Or here's a good example. We talk about the gender pay gap, right? So that's what we're going to talk about. We focus on that. How do we do? We need to kind of pay women more so that it brings the gap up. But there's an amazing documentary on Netflix where they talk about the gender pay gap. And it basically says one of the main contributors to this is actually it's a parental pay gap, because one of the biggest challenges is women take anything from 9 to 10 months off of work at some point in their life. Now, you take any man out of their workplace for 10 months, they will inevitably fall behind as well. So where we look at countries that have a more balanced approach in paternity leave, not just maternity leave, they allow the fathers to be able to take some more time off. They allow the fathers to be able to become the work from home dads. That's more socially acceptable.
And we have the shared parental leave now, which is a good thing as well.
Yeah, but I have to steal that off my wife.
Sorry?
I have to steal that time off of my wife. If I want to take increased paternity leave, she has to reduce her maternity leave. And I don't think
Return to work. This is the thing.
Exactly.
And the family is breaking down because she's returning to work, you stay with the child, but it doesn't ensure that your own career won't be impacted, you know? I think that men who have to take the choice as well to take parental leave as well have to go through stigma as well. I hear some stories.
Exactly. Yeah.
So it's really it's an approach to change. Yeah, a societal approach. Yeah.
We just so much that we need to look at here. You know, like you're going. We've got. I think we've got problems in the way we approach motherhood and work, the way we approach fatherhood and work, the way we approach race and work, the way we approach, you know, sex and sexuality and work and all of this stuff. And they're all kind of out of scope from a business. But I don't think that means that businesses can't do anything. I think you're seeing businesses like, I follow a company called Social Chain on social media, and they're quite big in, they've just employed, you know, a couple of roles in the business that are just there to focus on people. Like, they're not there to do anything else. It's not like I'm an operations manager and I line manage people. Their role is I'm here as like the people care manager or something, which is like, my job is to sit down with Jesse and James and to say, yeah, how are you doing, James? And you've just had a baby, haven't you? Yeah, I have. And how are you dealing with that? And frankly, I would turn around and say, 2 weeks was nowhere near enough for me. And I hate being back to work. And that, that chips away at our bodies and our brains and so on and so forth. And I think businesses do a lot more of being a bit more empathetic to each individual's cases.
Definitely. I think this is my point here, and I don't want to remove any personal fight for anyone. This is just my experience as a woman, and this is my personal experience that I'm sharing here. So there's no right or wrong answer here. I think everybody have different experience coming back. So, but definitely this has to be driven by policies. It's something that I'm really keen, and there's a lot of work ongoing, and also more proactive construction firm or any workplace, really, into making sure that the policy are respected as well, because it's not all about having shiny policy sitting on a shelf or on a system or processes, and then individual can then do a principal line manager can just escape the real implication that their decision can have.
Do you think it's like that kind of shift that we need from a company focusing on being compliant and doing the right thing by what they're told? So, and I think maternity and paternity leave is a really, really good example of that. And I've literally just kind of come to it in my brain now as we're talking. But like, I would always look at this from a safety point of view, but let's look at it from maternity and paternity point of view. Like you're required to provide the lady with 9 months off, and you're required to provide the gentleman with 2 weeks off. Some businesses do a little bit more. I think there's one of the biggest insurance companies in the UK, one of the bigger ones, I'm sure they provide the gentleman with 6 months optional paid leave.
It's what they call the enhanced maternity leave.
Yeah, they give them an enhanced leave. And I feel like that for me is a shift from doing what we're told to do to actually looking after our people and not just saying like, oh, Jesse, I look after you because I give you what I'm told to by law. And now when those businesses that do that little bit more, they're going, Jesse, I look after you because I want you to work for me, and I want you to be well and happy. And if I can do what I can to make you well, happy, comfortable, you know, feel like you're accepted, feel like you fit in, you're part of my culture, I damn well know that you're going to work hard for me, because I created the environment in which you can do that.
No, it's true. And I think there are like a lot of company who they are doing a really good job in terms of like providing maternity policies, providing enhanced maternity leave. But I think that from my personal experience, it's what's come up after. It's good to be paid for 6 months. And then you have the government maternity leave that kick off, and you can make the choice to come back to work or just stay for another 6 months with your baby. And I decided to come back because I really wanted to work. But I think that the return and the rehabilitation, it's something that has to be looked at really carefully, because it's great to leave more time to women, but bear in mind when they're coming back what they are going through, and they sleep deprived, and they're full of hormones, which make you uncertain, more emotionally sensitive. So I think this is like something we need more training in workplaces about. Okay, your line manager, you've got a woman coming back from maternity leave. It's her first day back. You can't stress her with jobs that need to be done within 2 days. You can't change her role on the day she's coming back without prior her speaking with her. It's simple. When you have to do change, just speak with the person. And there are a lot of like shifts you can't do on a first day, you know, just because that's the physiological state a woman is when she is coming back. It could trigger a lot of things.
Because you're kind of like a and I'm speaking from my own experience, like a completely different person like I am completely different person to what I was 4 weeks ago when I didn't have a baby.
But you know, you have also hormones, new hormones coming. It's like there are lots of interest about women and what's happened to their body, but something is going on into your body too, you know.
Exactly.
And and it's true. I'm not the same person. I'm not the same woman before and after I had a baby. I'm a new person. I look at things differently now.
Yeah,
and my priority is my child. I still want to fulfill myself as a human being, but I won't compromise my family.
Yeah.
And I won't compromise my relationship with my child. But it doesn't mean that I can't be a tremendous good workers.
Yeah.
I just need the amount of support when I first return. And I think that they should be like monitoring at least for 6 months when you come back from maternity leave. And what I find difficult is like, you don't have to just stick with compliance. Mm. Just do things differently. Go beyond. Use your experience to say, oh, maybe we should be more attentive because we know that women after maternity leave are inclined to postnatal depression. So we don't want to have to trigger anything going on. It's already difficult enough to have to return. You often have extra weight. Mm. You often sleep deprived. Mm. So it's all these things that and you look at yourself differently as well. So, and people might look at you differently too. Mm. It's like, and you can be judged as well for any decision. Whatever you take, you always be judged. You back now? Why are you back? Why don't you stay home a bit longer? There's no right or wrong answer. I always say that you have to go with what works for you. What do you want to do? What do you want to fulfill for yourself? And as long as you're happy as a mom, as a dad, as a parent, and your child is happy, is what does it count? Yeah.
I just want to come on that point you mentioned there. Did you get was that in your head then when you returned to work? You returned to work a bit earlier than traditional. Is that right?
Yes, I did, and I think I was really ambitious about returning back. And I was too ambitious.
That's your right as a human, as a woman, as a mother, to make that decision. And I'm assuming that wasn't, you know, just you, it would have been a conversation with your partner and so on and so forth, and family or whatever. But you make that decision. But was that in the back of your head then? I think what you were alluding to then, in the some people might be really questioning why you're coming back to work and maybe potentially questioning the relationship as a mother.
They question that even before you go on maternity leave. The thing is, like, I didn't start my maternity leave before 10 days before my due date.
Wow.
So I actually was trying to keep myself active. And you know, when you work, you keep yourself active. You leave home. And for me, I wanted to keep that activities. And I'm not working far. I wasn't working far from the office. So for me, but it was really hard. It was really hard. So up to 10 days before my due date, I went and I walked to the office. And people have something to say. Well, why are you doing that to yourself? And if I had to do it again, I would have done things differently, to be honest.
Okay. And I think the interesting thing here is as well, it's like, if you're just sticking, I think this what I'm going to say next kind of applies to much more than this maternity point of view. But I think this is a good example in that, you know, ensuring that you're having that good maternity leave, the good return to work, etc. The groundwork is laid from a business point of view way before before you even know that lady is thinking about having a child, or the man is thinking about having a child. It's like, so the way what I'm trying to get to you, if you imagine you didn't have a very transactional relationship with your manager, for example, right? Mm-hmm. So every time I'm your manager, for example, every time I ring you, I will say, "Hi Jesse, how are you?" Or you give me an answer of how you are, And now I pretty much cut into that response and say, that's really good. Have you done that report for me? It's a very transactional. I only talk to you because I want something, right? So let's say the company has this really good policy, because I've seen some companies do, of having regular check-ins with you whilst you're on maternity leave, right? If I have that pre kind of defined relationship of a transactional, poor quality relationship, every time I check in with you on maternity leave, it means nothing. But it's a good idea, but it means nothing. If I have a very kind of transformational, very relationship-based conversations with you, for example, when I say, hey, Jesse, how are you? I actually care about the response, and me and you have a really good relationship as manager and kind of delegate or whatever. When I do that policy from a business point of view of checking in with you, it means so much more, and it actually has a powerful effect. So the what we're actually talking about here is not necessarily like a policy in some sense. It's a for that one thing. It's that wider policy of having good managers. Like, I think a great,
it's human skills. It's human skills, and I think it comes back to what you said earlier. It comes back to culture as well, because it's Jesse, how are you? It's like people move on before you can even say how you are. And sometimes you want to say more. But in UK, it's like, how are you, bye? How are you? And the person is already gone. And it's like, it's, this is really hard for me, because I'm French, but I also have other background. And in introducing this other background, it's really about caring. When you ask people how they are, you really listen. And it's something that even now, after more than 10 years in UK, I still just can't have my head around this how are you question. Because when someone asks me, I really want to say how I am. And sometimes I'm being so French, because I'm like, I'm having a bad day. I'm like frank. But people are not ready to sit down and listen really to you, even if we've got all this, like, it's time to talk, time to listen. Why do you have to force people to have to do that? It should be every day. Why once a year you should have a campaign to say it's time to talk, let's have a cup of tea and tell me how you are? No, this is a everyday skills, and it's a soft skills, it's a human skills. So yeah, you're right in the sense that sometimes it's like, oh, Jesse, how are you doing? You're in the middle of your maternity leave, and it's like really seems like, okay, I tick my box. I check how is she, and this is bring really a lot of anxiety when you're a woman, because you start to question, hold on one second, I'm pretty sure there must be something going on behind. I might still have my job when I'm going to come back. This is becoming like really strange that I've been asked about, but nothing is said about the job, nothing is said about, and then this is when anxiety, new anxieties, because I didn't know what was anxiety before I got pregnant, actually, because it's during pregnancy, you start to see some shift in the way that you feel as well. So, and anxiety was like, never experienced anxiety before on all my life. It's really was something really new for me, and mixed with stress and depression. It's really a cocktail you don't have to drink, James. You don't want to drink this cocktail, because it's just like, it takes time to flush out of your body.
No, I understand that. I can empathize with that. And I think what you said there about culture is interesting, because that comes back to what we were talking about when we first started talking, that shift when you move over to England, is that simple shift is that I get it. Like in England, I understand what the challenge you're getting, because I was trained from my parents and my grandma, that you don't air your dirty laundry. You know, you leave the door very, very cut, like you have a face on, you have a front on, you look nice, you're presentable, and you don't talk money, you don't talk problems. And people say, how are you? You say, I'm really well, thank you. How are you? And that's it. Mm-hmm. And I remember myself as a young man, not even that long ago, I remember myself saying to somebody, you know, when you ask someone how they are, like, it's just a figure of speech. I don't actually give a shit how you are. Like, I remember me saying that. I remember, because that was how I was trained in, I think it is a very British thing. It's a very British thing. We do care. We really do care. But it's like we've been culturally trained to not air our dirty laundry. So in that aspect, when we're trying to make this shift now, I'm trying to tell British managers, for example, to be a bit more empathetic towards their what's it, subordinates, you know, to say, how are you? And actually listen to the response. They don't know how to respond when Jessie goes in her very French manner, oh my God, I'm terrible. I feel like I'm going to cry any minute. Or even worse, you actually cry. You know, a British bloke would not know what to do. They would really struggle in that situation because we've never been taught how to deal with this stuff. And these human skills that you're talking about are absolutely vital, but we don't teach it. I had a really good conversation with Sarah Brummett a couple of weeks back, and we talked about communication. It's such a vital skill. But when are you ever taught to communicate? Ever? Like, think back to when someone was in school, somebody said, hey, we're going to actually teach you how to communicate. Like, no one ever did that. It's kind of done through your experiences, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but it depends on, is your experience like around the world? I think that people who have traveled around the world can communicate a hell of a lot better than somebody like me who's just been in Northamptonshire, because it's been a hard slog. And I think having this podcast has really helped me learn how to communicate. So I'm speaking with people all around the world now, and that's been a journey for me. But that's just one example of how it makes, you know, somebody that's gone from one culture to another a hell of a lot more emotionally intelligent, potentially a better communicator, potentially more resilient as well. You know, it's all of these things, which brings me to kind of my kind of next point, is that I feel like we need to shift our conversation around diversity from ticking a box as to like how many people from the BAME community are we employing? Right, yeah, that's a 20%. Great. How many Asians are we employing? Oh, good. That's another 20%. How many women? How many to the benefits of having a diverse board, of having a diverse management team, of all the, you will think completely different to how I think because of where you've come from and where I've come from. And that's a good thing.
Yeah, I think it comes down to diversity of thinking as well. And this is something I'm really keen. It's not all about, obviously I have different ideas. I wasn't brought up in UK. I come from multicultural family. My parents left a country themselves. And then they arrived in France 40 years ago, and they had to learn. And I did the shift from France to UK. So it's bringing even more languages, and it's bringing more thinking and more ideas. So and I'm just craving to have like people who think different out there, and being able to speak about their experience. I think it's so important to have a platform for everyone and not always the same people to be out there and speaking. And I think this is crucial. And if I'm here today, it's really to say to people who look different, to people who are disabled, have different sexual orientation, just go out there, just speak about your experience, because otherwise we just don't know what's going on. And it's really a shame, because you don't always have like a camera pointing out of what disadvantage people are going through every day, and you can't show it to the world. This is not how sometimes things happen. So it's really important to give a platform to people to be able to speak about. And I think that now going forward, there's going to be a real shift, because people have started to speaking up. about it without having a platform. We don't need a platform anymore. We're in the 21st century, and you just work on your branding and you go out there. And sometimes it's painful because people are just not comfortable to hear about this. And I'm really glad that you provide me with the opportunity, James, today to be able to speak on the daylight, because it's something I was doing. But you know, you always hide yourself behind and like trying to do your own thing and thinking that you're doing something wrong. Don't get me wrong, at the beginning I was like, this is not normal, trying to get people to gather them to try to speak about the experience of working in a firm. What is your experience as a woman who look like me? Can you tell me? And I nearly feel bad to have to do that, because I said, I might get told off because I'm having this kind of like mini group, and we're challenging the status quo. We're speaking about things that make people uncomfortable. So I think it's time to go out there, and we're getting there. I'm really sorry for the people who feel really uncomfortable about this message. It's not about them. It's really not about them, and what we need is people who can be themselves in someone else's shoes and think a second, okay, all done. I'm here, I'm sitting here. Can I think about how Jesse had to navigate the construction world being a woman and being on top of that, other things, on top of being a woman? And I think this is what we need. It's more people who have compassion and empathy. It's not a fight here. I'm not trying to get my point across. I completely agree that people have different opinion. So
I think you kind of hit the nail on the head. It's about, for me, I think, as I've kind of, you know, said a few times, you know, born and raised in a very sheltered environment, that will take time to change, but you know, a very, very sheltered environment. Went to a very simple school, was not really destined to do very well at all, but my typical environment was, you know, white working class males was my environment. And then I was born and raised by my mum and my grandma. So two very clear environments. And it wasn't until I probably entered the working environment when I start to talk to, you know, Eastern Europeans, people from the BAME community, Asians working over here, and understanding them. And gradually over the years, over a very long time, you're starting to understand people's challenges, in which my perception of kind of discrimination and equality has changed. In that, you know, when people used to raise the conversation of equality with me, I would, and this was not so long ago, I would be coming at it from a stance of being like, well, I don't think we need groups like Black Lives Matter. I don't think we need groups like feminism, because we have laws in place that mean everybody can get a job. But now I can, because I've seen and had these conversations, and like you've said, people have shared their stories on platforms, and I've spoken to you, I've spoken to Sam Goodman, who we'll hear from in a couple of weeks, and I'm seeing firsthand the challenges they're having right now in the 21st century. So I'm like, oh shit, this stuff actually really still exists. There is casual and systemic discrimination still going on. There is even blatant, you know, derogative statements and things like that. Sam Goodman shared a post the other week, you know, a kind of like being gay in America. And the comments he received from the book that he's written about his kind of life as a gay man, and being in a gay relationship and having a daughter in that relationship. The comments, Jesse, that on this post was embarrassing for me to read. I didn't know what to say. I really didn't. So I decided I would share with him something that's a bit risky from some people's point of view. And I told him in the comments box, open to everybody, considering I have a reasonable following on LinkedIn, this could have gone really wrong. But I thought, I want to be honest with him. So I told him in this post, you know, it wasn't so long ago, Sam, I didn't understand why people are gay. I didn't get it. I was that very stereotypical person that went, it was against biology. You know, you shouldn't be gay. And now, frankly, I don't care. Like, Sam, if you want to love somebody and that makes you happy, then I it's nothing to do with me. And frankly, I love the fact, and I've completely shifted, and I love the fact now that he can be with another man if he wants to. And they can adopt a daughter. I think they adopted, I'm not really sure. And they can have a daughter as well. That's beautiful. But the only way I got to that position, if I'm brutally honest, was meeting my wife 10 years ago, who has had a very diverse friendship group of different ethnicities, of different religions. She has gay people in her family, you know, and I got exposed to all of these different people. I started to see them as a person and not as this conversation that I see on social media or in the Sun newspaper or on the bloody telly. I'm actually starting to take it on a case-by-case basis, person and person. So I think you're absolutely right, is that when people put their stories out on this platform and they just say, look, I'm not here to shout at you and say, you know, this is it. I'm just here to tell you the challenges that I've had.
And you open the conversation as well, and you listen, and you allow people to express themselves. I always put things out there and I let people... and unless people express themselves, because everybody has a point of view, and it's a respect to have. So nothing wrong with that.
Exactly. So I think you're 100% right there. I think the more people that share their stories, it just helps people like James, that was 10, 15 years ago, you know, is a completely different person. And I would have never changed if I didn't hear people's stories, because I never knew it existed. And that's a really naive place to be. And it really worries me that I have to communicate that out to people. And it's scary because it makes me feel a bit vulnerable to somebody taking that the wrong way now and saying, oh, James used to be a racist. And no, I never was. I just didn't understand.
I think it's coming down to that. And well done on making the shift. This is the thing. It's we talk a lot about like educating. And people have to go and do their own research and find out, and then have a new opinion. I've seen people around me changing, so it's completely human. We all evolve every day.
yeah, definitely. I'm conscious I've kept you for a very long time, Jesse, and I'm sure you've got a daughter to deal with and a
she came behind the door. She's like, "What are you doing, mommy?"
How old is she now, your daughter?
She's 17 months now.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so a year and a half.
What's that? Up, running around, shouting?
Oh, yes. She's like full on walking, discovering, because it's the age that they want to discover. They're testing you a lot.
Yeah.
You're going to have a fun time, James. So enjoy now that she doesn't move a lot.
Yeah, I can lay next to her as I was. I had a call this morning too, 10 o'clock, and I had a spare hour. And I thought, I just go and give her a cuddle. And it's so easy. She just lays there. She doesn't move.
But going forward, she's going to start moving. She's going to have an opinion as well. Yeah. She can't express herself completely. But you can tell when she's happy, she's not happy. She tell you, and it's just... it's really a fun time. Every day is different. It's like amount of like diversity of on the development of a child is just amazing. It's fascinating.
I can't wait as well to just see her when she grows up. It'll be a different world. It'll be such a different world. And I can't wait to hear, like, I can't wait to be taught by her what this new world will be like.
And also she will be inspired by you, by having this platform and allowing people to have to speak about the experience. And she can hopefully go back and see all the video you've done. This is impactful and it's powerful. I think it's really important to leave a legacy. And what I'm doing now, it's because I want to demonstrate to my daughter, to myself as well, that you can challenge the status quo. You don't have to say yes when something happens. It can be hard, but you can try to do, even if it's like a marginal gains, you could be part of like as a change. Yeah.
I think that's right. I remember not so long ago seeing all this stuff of Black Lives Matter, and me and my wife were sitting there and going, you know, I want to do something, but I don't know what to do. And I knew I had a conversation with you coming up, and that just one little thing that I could do was to be able to, you know, provide a platform for somebody. And that's just, for me, that's an achievement in its own right. And that's powerful. And that marginal gains piece you said there, I love that. I think if everybody does that little thing, you know, think about that. If everybody in the entire world did one little thing towards sharing a story, towards, you know, increasing equality, towards feminism, sexual preferences, whatever, think of how awesome the world would be. It'd be absolutely amazing.
Mm. Yeah, I think I'm really, I have a lot of hope.
Good. Right, Jesse, I've kept you away from your daughter way too long, and I'm going to go see mine for a little bit. And actually, we can actually have our Saturdays back.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for your time. Thank you for providing with a platform. And I'm really, really grateful for the opportunity. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Okay, peeps, hope you enjoyed that. Again, just a final reminder that everything we're talking about in here is coming from a good place. We are trying to make the safety profession better, and I think we can do that through making the safety profession more diverse. The lack of diversity in our profession is frankly shocking. The conversations that we have are very open, honest and frank, and we recorded them a hell of a long time ago. This mini series has been building for a long time. We've got lots of amazing stuff coming on. We're kicking off with two very open and honest conversations, firstly with Jesse, and then next month, on the first Monday of the month, we'll have our next episode of our mini series where we talk to Sam Goodman, who talks about challenges of coming out as a gay man in America. So thanks for listening. Don't forget to check out Paradigm Human Performance, and don't forget to check out Project Miletium. But otherwise, I'll catch you next week. Safe.